welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday, the 1st of August, 2022, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. It's the beginning of another week, and we haven't had a Real Britannia for a couple of weeks now, and I'm very much looking forward to today's episode. We have a lot of things to discuss. I've been wanting to talk to my co-host here, Max Masson, about the Conservative leadership election ever since Boris was first stabbed in the back. So, Max Masson from Western Spring is here with us, of course, today. Max, good day, sir. How are you doing?
Good day to you. Yeah, I'm doing very well indeed. And yeah, the Conservative leadership election is dragging on now. It's set to become the sort of a long-running saga throughout the summer now. I think they've made a definite mistake by making the process so drawn out, because it means that now that we're down to two candidates, it's just those two candidates slagging each other off, and they're effectively providing anybody else, like the Labour Party, who might want to criticise the Conservative Party, with just tons of ammunition that they can use to slag off whoever it is that eventually does become the Conservative leader. And they've had, you know, the best part of 2 months' worth of ideas thrown up. So if Liz Truss, for example, becomes the Prime Minister, then Rishi Sunak will have given the Labour Party, his team will have given the Labour Party a very substantial amount of ammunition they can use to attack Liz Truss. And if it goes the other way around, then Liz Truss's team will have given the Labour Party a tremendous amount of ammunition they can use to slag off Rishi Sunak. And so I think the Conservatives, to some extent, have shot themselves in the foot here by trying to appear to be ultra democratic instead of just get cracking on and finding themselves a new leader.
I think they've shot themselves in the foot anyway, just by getting rid of Boris Johnson, to be honest. I mean, OK, he had his faults, but he had lots and lots of charisma. He did get Brexit done. He did get the lockdown lifted. He did prevent us from having mandatory vaccinations, which was happening in places like Germany and Austria. He won with a landslide in that election. He won all those traditionally red seats, and I think the public supported him. I mean, what did they take him down for? They said that he had a COVID fine, which is the equivalent of a parking fine. He had these parties that were going on, which was basically just after work. He was having a drink, and then they had a question over his leadership. They had a vote on whether they had confidence in him, and people voted, and they said, yes, we do still have confidence in him, and he's supposed to then not be the victim of a no confidence vote for another year. He's supposed to be safe for another year. And yet within weeks, they were saying to him, no, he's got to go, because he wasn't honest about this pincher fellow who was apparently pinching blokes on the bottom when he was getting drunk at a party somewhere. So it was basically somebody that was employed by the Conservative Party. And Boris Johnson said he wasn't aware that there were these allegations against him. And because of that, all the rest of the Conservative Party then stabbed him in the back and said, we're going to refuse to work with you, which I think really is not going to go down very well with the Conservative members, because they voted for Boris Johnson. He won this vote of no confidence, and he should still be there. And I think he was the best of a bad bunch, to be honest. He did have charisma. He did encourage people to get behind the Conservative Party. And what is the choice that we have now? Rishi Sunak or Liz Truss? And neither of which, I think, is a patch on Boris Johnson. I think the Conservative Party have really shot themselves in the foot. I mean, before we even get to this long, drawn-out, protracted process, which you're pointing to there, Max, but I just think it was very stupid of them to get rid of Boris in the first place. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, there was a campaign by members of the Conservative Party where they have been campaigning over the last couple of weeks or so for Boris to stay, or for Boris to be on the ticket, so that it will be a three-way race between Rishi Sunak, Liz Truss and Boris, so that they can re-elect him. Because there have been a number of opinion polls taken where as many as 85% of the Conservative rank and file members think Boris should remain the Prime Minister of England, which is quite amazing, really, isn't it? And I can think back, I can remember when Margaret Thatcher was deposed by, I think it was Michael Heseltine, and it was a coup sort of organised by Michael Heseltine. And I can remember on the actual day, because there was a vote of no confidence in Margaret Thatcher, which she won, but she just didn't win it by a convincing majority. There was the majority that she won by was fairly small, similar to the majority that Boris Johnson got. In fact, I think a bit smaller than Boris Johnson's majority in the vote of no confidence that he had a little while back. But the point is that instead of spitting in the eye of her detractors and sticking to her guns and staying where she was, Margaret Thatcher decided that she would step down. And the same thing happened with David Cameron. There was a vote of no confidence in him that he won. I'm not sure actually whether there was one that he had.
It was with Brexit, wasn't it? It's just after Brexit. He said, I'm going to have to step down because I was leading the country to stay in the European Union. Now the country has voted against. So I'm going to step down within 7 days, which effectively left the country in chaos.
It wasn't a formal vote of no confidence, I don't think, in David Cameron. But the point is, anyway, the fact of the matter is that Conservative prime ministers don't tend to dig their heels in and soldier on if they think that the majority they've got is too small and there are too many Conservative MPs that think they're unsuitable. Then even though it's not a majority, they kind of chicken out and just step down and allow another leadership election to take place. But one of the things I thought was interesting was that of all the people who initially were nominated and were on the ticket as far as potentially becoming the leader of the Conservative Party, there were 11 of them. Rishi Sunak, Liz Truss, Kemi Badenoch, who I'd never heard of before, Suella Braverman, who I had heard of before, but she wasn't a particularly prominent character, Jeremy Hunt, who's sort of seen better days, I think, as far as his political prospects are concerned. Penny Mordaunt, that I'd not sort of really heard of before, but she seemed to be a reasonably respectable candidate. Tom Tugendhat, Nadeem Zahawi, and then the well-known, this sort of household name, Raymond Chisty, who's probably only a household name in his own household, I would imagine, because I've never heard of him before. Sajid Javid and Grant Shapps. So there we had 11 candidates. Three of them were white British. Two of them were people of Jewish extraction or partially Jewish extraction. And then the other six were of non-white immigrant backgrounds, basically. And so where people accuse the Conservative Party of being a racist party and where they sort of continually whine about racism, etc., that kind of proves that the pendulum has certainly swung probably a bit too far in the other direction now. And perhaps we can look forward to the pendulum swinging back.
Well, especially if you think non-whites make up 15% of the population, but from what you're saying there, they're making up 70 or 80% of the original Conservative hopefuls in the leadership challenge. And we also have a backer of Rishi Sunak, quite a prominent backer, who is saying that if the public doesn't vote for Rishi, then the public are being racist. And of course, we're just waiting for that one to come up there. But I do think the Conservative Party, the members, I think they will want to vote for a white candidate. I mean, they are conservative-minded, traditionalist-minded people. And I think the instinct there will be to vote for somebody who is ethnically British to lead Britain. Although they will always say, well, we're open to other people joining the Conservative Party and anybody can work their way up. I think there will be an instinctive desire to see somebody white. And I also think that Liz Truss is probably going to be a better choice than Rishi Sunak anyway, although she has made quite a few failures as in her role as being foreign secretary. She doesn't appear to really know very much about history, doesn't really appear to know very much about geopolitics, but she does appear to be somebody that takes the initiative. And I say this because the other day there was a leadership debate and the presenter of the leadership debate actually fainted live on stage, and straight away Liz Truss got off the stage to make sure that the presenter was okay, which I thought showed that she does actually have leadership potential. potential. I'm not quite sure what Rishi Sunak was doing, whether he was just dithering around there on the stage, but she took the initiative and went forwards to check that they were okay. And I think a lot of people would have just stood there saying, oh, what's going on? Somebody go over there and look at the presenter. But she didn't. She jumped straight in there to check that the woman was okay, which really, I was quite impressed by that. Did you see that? Did you notice that at all, Max? Did you hear about that?
I wasn't watching that debate, but I did see the reports of it afterwards, where the commentator or the person comparing the thing had collapsed. And it was sort of evident that Liz Truss pretty much straight away went down to see if this woman was okay. It's interesting, actually, that the Russian government have obviously decided they don't like Liz Truss, and I think probably the feeling's mutual as far as Vladimir Putin's concerned. They criticised Liz Truss and used the fact that she'd gone to see if this woman was okay as evidence that she's too much of a hysterical woman to have her finger on the nuclear button, which I thought was quite sort of amusing. You know, by showing that you're a caring human being means that you're too hysterically female to be trusted to have your finger on the nuclear button, which I thought was quite strange. And yet anybody, any sort of unbiased person viewing what happened would have drawn the same conclusion you did, that she was just showing that she was a caring person. And it's what sort of anybody would, you know, if you walk along the street and somebody collapses on the pavement by the side of you, then you sort of bend down and check them to see if they're okay and ask them how they are, that sort of thing. Presumably the Russians and perhaps this sort of indicating that Vladimir Putin would be of this ilk would just walk past if somebody collapsed on the pavement by the side of them. I don't know. But I just thought it was amusing as well.
Yeah, that's the opposite of the way that I would have seen it. I mean, I saw that as quite masculine and showing leadership and showing initiative rather than just standing around and waiting for someone else to say something. Of course, she has had interactions with Sergei Lavrov, and she got her history wrong. She got parts of Russia wrong that she thought that were part of the Donetsk and Luhansk republics, and they weren't. They were actually parts of the Russian Federation, so she got that bit wrong. So she really hasn't endeared herself to the Russians, but she has spoken about the European Court of Human Rights. She said that she wants to go over all the pieces of law that where we are still obeying European Union law rather than our own law, and if the case may be, to actually withdraw from the European Court of Human Rights, because the European Court of Human Rights is the one that's put a stop on this Rwanda plan. Both Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss have said that they wish to continue with this Rwanda plan, but it's been held up there. Rishi says that he wants to have a cap on immigration, and I think Liz Truss is pretty much saying the same and talking about this Rwanda plan. And they're obviously just trying to appeal to the conservative-minded voters. As far as the trans agenda is concerned, Liz Truss is the one that actually put a stop to people being able to self-identify, which was Theresa May's idea, that instead of having to have a doctor's diagnosis, you could just self-identify as being female and then change all your legal documents. Well, Liz Truss was the one that actually put a stop to that. Rishi Sunak has also said that a woman is a woman, and if a man presents as a woman, then that does not make them into a biological woman. That makes them into a trans woman. And he has also said that women's spaces need to be protected from biological males. So on both those points, immigration and on the trans agenda, there really isn't that much difference between them. They have talked about taxes, and Rishi Sunak, I think he wants to put taxes up, whereas Liz Truss is saying rather than paying for this COVID lockdown right away, what we should be doing is deferring that in the same way that we deferred payments for World War II for decades, basically. And she's wanting to do the same thing with COVID. So there is a difference there with taxes. But apart from that, there really isn't that much difference between them. Do you know what they're saying about the economy much, Max? Have you been following that?
Well, the economy appears to be looking as if it's going to become very difficult over the next few years. We've got this inflation now running at sort of 10% per annum. It looks as if it might go higher. Inflation is very difficult to stop once it starts, and so that's why you do need to keep a handle on it. And I think, as we said last time, the what politicians generally do is they make a mistake in terms of assigning the cause of inflation. And I think in both cases, both Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss have failed to identify the fact that inflation is caused by the amount of money in the economy being increased disproportionately to the availability of goods and services that are available to be purchased with that money. And it was furlough that was the cause of the inflation, together with our current involvement in the in supporting Ukraine. I think that that supporting Ukraine is probably in the interests of Europe. So I don't sort of criticise the government for wanting to do that. But the fact of the matter is that when you have a war, what you do is you create lots of hardware and then you blow it up. And that then reduces the amount of goods and services available to be purchased compared with the amount of money floating around in the economy. So wars are always inflationary. Every major war there's ever been has been followed by a period of high inflation. And so hopefully we'll be able to get this situation in Ukraine and Russia sorted out before too long, because I think it's damaging the economies of most Western countries. It is also damaging the economy of Russia as well. And it's in everybody's interest, really, to have a as rapid a negotiated settlement as can possibly be achieved. We've seen petrol prices rise. They're starting to come down again now, though, which is good. But electricity prices seem to still be rising, and the predictions are that electricity is going to become extremely expensive as we go into the winter. And I was listening to a radio program as I was driving yesterday, and I can't think who the interviewer was now, but he was talking to somebody who is an expert in terms of home warming and central heating systems and things of this sort. And this chap was just basically saying that that the cost of heating your home in the next over the next winter is going to become exorbitantly high for just about everybody, to such an extent that people are going to have to start wearing extra layers of clothing in their house, are going to have to start taking cold showers, and things of this sort. So the interviewer said, you know, well, what did people do before North Sea gas became available, which then sort of made that central heating was within the grasp of most people? And he said, well, yeah, people do have to wear extra layers of clothing. That's what people did in prior to that. And I'm old enough to be able to remember that myself. I think we've got a fairly grim period ahead of us. And the prediction was that it probably will take, even if the war in Ukraine is sorted out fairly swiftly, is probably going to take, perhaps 3 or 4 years for markets to get back to the sort of level they were previously. So, you know, that's something which which has happened. I don't know how much effort could have been invested in preventing Russia from invading Ukraine. You know, Liz Truss went out there and spoke to the Russians just prior to the invasion, when Vladimir Putin was talking about it and sort of making threatening noises. And I don't know whether there could have been a bit more pressure placed upon the Ukrainians for them to compromise, whether there could have been a bit more pressure applied to the Russians, and they could have been made aware of the extent of the sanctions that would be imposed by the West, and so therefore would have a keener impression of the sort of damaging effect that those sanctions would have on the Russian economy, so that both sides, Ukraine and Russia, would have been prepared to have just wound their necks in very slightly, and we could have avoided an actual war. Because at the end of the day, all the Ukrainians have had to say to Russia is that they've got no intention of invading Russia. And as from what, from as far as I'm aware, they don't have any intention of invading Russia. So as far as Russia is concerned, you know, what the Russians want is for the Ukrainians to pledge that they will not ever attack Russia. And the Ukrainians have got no intention of ever attacking Russia. So it should have been the easiest deal to broker imaginable. The fact that that deal wasn't brokered indicates the failings from a negotiating point of view of the various people who did visit Russia and did visit Ukraine just prior to the war. But hopefully, in the weeks to come, hopefully Liz Truss will develop a new strategy in terms of her dealing with the Russians, and we can get some kind of a peace negotiated, and because that will do a massive amount to improving the economic prospects both of Russia and of the West, and once we've got those improved economic prospects, it should then be possible for us to get inflation under control. Like if we can bring down the price of gas in the same way that oil is now coming down, then it should be possible for us to regain control of the economy, get inflation down to a negligible level as it was before, and that will be in everybody's interests.
Well, if the electricity bills are going up domestically, they're also going to go up as far as productivity is concerned, and you could end up seeing businesses going out of business because they're just not able to pay the electricity bills. I mean, it's all fairly serious. There doesn't appear to be that much difference between Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss as far as Russia is concerned. They each try to outdo one another in being against Russia. So there really isn't that much difference between them. They're both still talking about net zero and the green agenda, although I think Liz Truss is talking about walking that back slightly, waiting until we actually have the technology available before we transfer to all these supposedly more greener ways of doing things. But we could all end up going back to solid fuel in order to heat our houses, which, as Putin has pointed out, would then also end up still coming from Siberia, because that's the cheapest bit where we can get the timber from. Well, we've also had a lot of sport that's been in the news recently. The English football team, the Lionesses, I believe, are doing very well. And it's also been highlighted the fact that they are very, very white. There was a recent BBC commentator complained about the fact that the team was too white. And what does that have to do with anything? Surely you want the best players on the team, not players that are just there simply because of what race they are. But this is besides this, there also seems to be masses of support for these Lionesses, because I believe they're doing very well in the women's soccer league tables, Max. Have you been watching some of these games? You got any thoughts on the Lionesses?
Yeah, I have watched some of the games, actually. And what I'd say, first of all, though, is that people from ethnic minorities are very often interviewed, and they say, oh, well, you know, when they looked at an industry, or when they looked at a football team, or when they looked at, a music orchestra or something of this sort in the past, they haven't seen anybody that looks like them. And they felt that the fact they didn't see anybody that looks like them, they felt that was damaging to their self-image, and was then mentally crippling them, so that they couldn't actually make their way in the world as well as they might otherwise be able to if the people they saw above them as role models were looked the same as them, you see. And yet what's happening is in recent times we've had a move towards promoting non-white people in virtually every field that there, and this comes from government down, that there is pressure on people who are employing teachers, pressure on people who are employing policemen, pressure on people who are employing doctors, etc., that they need to bias their recruiting decisions such that they recruit a disproportionately large number of people from ethnic minorities, so that people from ethnic minorities, when they look at the people that are above them in various sort of stratas of society, can see people that look like them so that they can feel motivated by looking at them. And yet what we're told is that race is a social construct, that race is meaningless, that race is only skin deep. If all that of that is true, then seeing a football team which is entirely white, if that football team represents the country that you live in and is doing very well, then surely you would you would feel motivated, and you would feel inspired by watching that football team. The fact that the people that compose that football team weren't black like you shouldn't stop you from being inspired by watching them. If race is a social construct, race is something that's meaningless, etc. But the fact that there's so much emphasis placed upon people that are in the public eye, people that are in positions where they would be role models, there's so much emphasis placed upon them having to be from ethnic minorities, and not just ethnic minorities being represented to the same sort of degree that they represent the population generally, so that if there are 15% of the population is from an ethnic minority, that 15% of the footballers in major league football matches are from the ethnic minorities. No, they won't stop there. They push and push and push until they achieve a situation where such is the bias in the recruitment and selection of people that the proportion of ethnic minorities is wholly disproportionate compared with the percentage of people who are from the ethnic majority, from the native British people. And so in viewing the criticisms that were levelled at the England team about this, we have to view it against that background. And it's interesting that the lady who is the coach of the England team, Serena Wiegman, I think her name is, and I'm not quite sure what her nationality is, but I know she's not English, but she's of European descent. And she seems to have done a brilliant job in terms of coaching the England team, so that their fortunes have been turned around. And the England women's team is now regarded as being one of the best teams in the world. And obviously, as a result, in these current championships, it looks as if we've got a very, very good chance of winning the championship. There is so much in the news, in the media at the moment about race. We're constantly being told that race is a social construct, race is meaningless, we should completely ignore race, etc. And yet it is the thing, you know, if you scan news websites, if you scan newspapers, then you find a wholly disproportionate amount of the news is orientated around people's race. And the same people that are telling us that, oh, race doesn't matter, are the people that are telling us, by their actions and their comments and their continual focus on race, that race does matter and that race is a very important thing. And just as young black people, when they look at a football team and they see that it's full of white people, may not necessarily be as inspired by that football team as they would be if the team was composed of black people, so young white people, when they look at our football teams and if they see a football team which is disproportionately populated by non-white people, then they're not going to feel so inspired by that team either, because they're not going to identify with those people in the same way. And so what we have to do is to have a far more grown-up discussion about race and the importance of race, so that the current the current zeitgeist is has got to change from being one where we pretend that race doesn't matter to one where we acknowledge the fact that it does matter. But as far as the women football team was concerned, I don't watch football regularly because I find that it's become a very cynical game. That a lot of the players, they don't look like me, so I don't feel inspired by watching them. I don't sort of identify with them, so I don't tend to watch those matches. And what I've found is that the male football players over the years have been so highly paid that they've become prima donnas to a great extent. And one of the things that really irritates me whenever I've watched the England men's team playing in the past is the fact that once they get a goal ahead or perhaps two goals ahead, if they're lucky, then they tend to hog the ball and they tend to waste time by kicking the ball backs and forwards between the goalie and the fullbacks and the halfbacks and not taking the ball forward and trying to score. And it just makes the game boring. And usually what happens is they'll get a goal ahead, then they'll fart about with kicking the ball backwards and forwards like this, and then they'll make a mistake and the other side will get the ball and then run down the pitch and whack it in the back of the net, and their lead is then gone and they've wasted so much time, they then hardly have enough time, sometimes don't have enough time to get another goal again in order to get in front. But the women's England football team was a revelation watching that match against Sweden the other day, because the women were very genuine and honest in the way that they played. There was no time wasting. They were constantly pushing the ball forward. I was very impressed with the accuracy of the passing. It was just impeccable. And the enthusiasm and the drive exhibited by the women players was absolutely excellent, and they won the match against Sweden. But it's interesting, if you look at the four teams that have made it into the semi-finals, three of those teams have been almost entirely white, and only one team was predominantly non-white, and that was the French team. The French team have now been knocked out. So it would appear that instead of criticising Serena Wiegmann for not having more non-white people in the team, it seems that Serena Wiegmann has actually chosen the players to represent England as our women's team. She's chosen them on the basis of their ability, not on the basis of their racial background. And this is what... and this shows that her motivations have been absolutely correct, and it would appear that the selector and the coach of the German team has done exactly the same thing, and the German team was I think there might have been one ethnic minority player amongst the German team, I can't quite remember exactly, but it was overwhelmingly white as well, and the Swedish team was almost entirely white, if not entirely white. And so it would seem that that there is a recognition on the part of the coaches for these football teams that white women footballers are as good as any others anywhere in the world. And we don't need to recruit large numbers of our female football teams from the ethnic minorities. And we'll probably find if the men who are the coaches and who are the selectors for men's football were as honest as the people who are the coaches and the selectors for women's football, we'd probably find that there'd be a whole lot less footballers from the ethnic minorities playing for England and a whole lot less foreign footballers playing in the Football League, and football would then become a pathway for young budding players in this country to go up through the various league divisions and eventually make it into the national team, which doesn't exist any longer, because what happens is that a particular town or a particular city will recruit people from abroad. And by recruiting people from abroad, they are effectively blocking the recruitment of young talent that could then be brought on and that could be developed and that could then eventually rise to the point where it's capable of representing our country. And as I say, I think if the people who are the selectors and the coaches for the England men's team need to take a leaf out of the book of Serena Wiegmann, because and a leaf out of the book of the selector for Sweden, a leaf out of the book for the selector for Germany, because they appear to have got it right, don't they?
Well, yeah, I mean, it seems as if there's more money that's involved in it, then they're going to end up hiring players from here, there and everywhere. If there's less money involved in it, then people are being hired upon their ability. And it would seem that those with the best ability at football appear to be white. I mean, it would be interesting to see the difference between the white males and the white females, and also between the females of the other races in sporting prowess, to see whether there is something that Europeans have amongst the females that give them that edge in football. I mean, we know that there are certain black races that excel at the 100-meter sprint, for instance, and that also excel at things like the hurdles. So it's perfectly possible that there also may be European females might be particularly good at something like football for some reason, some difference between the biology between European females and black African females, for instance. But yeah, it's very pleasing to see that white people are doing well, and that British people are doing well in sports at last. Well, shall we move into our greatest Britons now then, Max, do you think?
Yeah, we can do that.
Let's talk some more about William Stukeley. Last episode, we talked about how Stukeley drew his interpretations of Britain's megalithic remains from earlier sources. He did not claim to be given divine revelation about them. He believed the Druidic understanding of the world came through scientific study in the same way. He traced the Druids to Phoenician settlers, which ties in with the earliest British legends about settlers arriving from Syria and giving their name to the county of Surrey. He thought the Britons were a chosen nation, and that the Church of England had special favour from God. He criticised Britons who went abroad on a grand tour when they could stay within their own country and see the evidence that Britain was a central civilising power long before Rome, just from the size of Avebury, Silbury Hill and Stonehenge. And it is interesting that at the time, there were authors that were trying to claim that Stonehenge and Avebury had actually been built by the Romans. And it was Stukeley that was saying, well, no, these were built by people before the Romans. And it shows that we had a certain level of technology in Britain that they didn't actually have in Europe. It shows we were far advanced from a lot of Europe. When you look at the size of some of these stones, it's just incredible that they were actually able to maneuver them about. And we also talked a little bit about the imminent godhood and the religious side of things, because he was basically tying in religious ideas and Christian ideas in with pagan ideas, and presenting Stonehenge and Avebury as megalithic structures representative of those ideas. And he really did sort of set off a renewed interest in Druidry. You could say that he was the expert in Druidry of his day. And then onwards from him, there became a renewed interest in pre-Christian British religion, and also in the megaliths and the stones, which he popularised. I don't know if there was anything else that you want to bring up, Max, or highlight that we were talking about in the earlier episodes.
Well, really, just emphasising what you've been saying there about his ideas, creating this sort of melding of Christianity and also Druidry, and as you said, the idea of immanence as far as the Almighty is concerned, as far as a deity is concerned, that's something which is an idea which in more recent times has started to factor in religious ideas. If we look at organizations in the United States, there's the National Alliance over there, which has created the Cosmotheist Community Church, and where one of the main ideas of their church is of the imminence of the life force, effectively.
And I also think I want to highlight the fact that he was drawing attention to the Britishness of Druidry and the Britishness of early Christianity, and laying claim to both of those as being an essential part of Britain's heritage. Because at the time, the church was splitting apart from Roman Catholicism, and the Church of England was starting to gather a sense of its own national pride. And he was tying that in with pre-Christian Druidry, with those beliefs as well, and just having a sense of pride in being British. Which we don't have today, because they try to say that we really didn't know very much until the Romans came. Whereas what he was saying is we knew a lot, and actually we were equals with the Romans. Well, I found a piece on Wikipedia about Avebury itself and Stukely and how he set about trying to prevent the destruction of the stones, which I thought was quite interesting. In the latter part of the 17th and then the 18th centuries, destruction at Avebury reached its peak, possibly influenced by the rise of Puritanism in the village, a fundamentalist form of Protestant Christianity that vehemently denounced things considered to be pagan, which would have included pre-Christian monuments like Avebury. The majority of the standing stones that had been a part of the monument for thousands of years were smashed up to be used as building material for the local area. This was achieved by lighting a fire to heat the sarsen stone, then pouring cold water onto it to create weaknesses in the rock, and finally smashing at the fire-cracked rock with a sledgehammer. I mean, this is absolute Bolshevism that was going on here. And you have to remember that at first they did this to the churches and the monasteries, and they destroyed the old churches and monasteries because they said that they were full of papistry and idolatry. And then after that, they moved on to smashing up Avebury and Stonehenge. I mean, this mentality has always been there amongst us, this Luddite mentality of wanting to just destroy beauty and things that we don't understand from the past. So it's very sad that this was going on. It reached its peak in the 17th and the 18th century.
And interesting that we've criticised ISIS in more recent times for doing the same thing out in Syria and at sites of historic interest in the Middle East.
Yeah, it's the same mentality, isn't it? There's a certain section amongst us that just wants to destroy rather than building. In 1719, the antiquarian William Stukely visited the site where he witnessed the destruction being undertaken by the local people. Between then and 1724, he visited the village and its monument six times, sometimes staying for 2 or 3 weeks at the Catherine Wheel Inn. In this time, he made meticulous plans of the site, considering it to be a British temple and believing it to having been fashioned by the Druids, the Iron Age priests of northwestern Europe in the year 1859 BC. He developed the idea that the two inner circles were a temple to the moon and to the sun, respectively, and eventually came to believe that Avebury and its surrounding monuments were a landscaped portrayal of the Trinity, thereby backing up his erroneous ideas that the ancient Druids had been followers of a religion very much like Christianity. And I would contend that his ideas were not erroneous. There were a lot of similarities between Druidry and Christianity. In actual fact, it was the same name of a god. They called their god Yisu, the Druids did, and they didn't actually change the name of the god once the god became known as Jesus. And I think he was quite correct. I mean, Stonehenge was built round about the year 1859 BC. I think they say it was round about 2000 BC, 2500 BC. And, you know, just the size of it is absolutely incredible. There was nothing else that was being built like that at the time. The only thing you have close to it is the pyramids in Egypt. I think Silbury Hill is the largest man-made structure in the whole of Europe. And again, that was built around about 2000 BC. I guess people had looked at them before, and where they'd fallen out of use, they didn't really know what they were for. So by saying that these structures were temples, that was a new idea at the time. So I guess that was quite revolutionary in his thought. Well, Stukely was disgusted at the destruction of the sarsen stones in the monument, and he named those local farmers and builders who were responsible. He remarked that this stupendous fabric, which for some thousands of years had braved the continual assaults of weather, and by the nature of it, when left to itself, like the pyramids of Egypt, would have lasted as long as the globe, hath fallen a sacrifice to the wretched ignorance and avarice of a little village unluckily placed within it. And, I mean, it still goes on today. I mean, in Wales, they've got megalithic structures. You've got dolmens, which are like two or three large stone uprights with a capstone on the top of it. And you look at them and you think, well, they've been stood there for thousands of years without falling down. And then you get an organisation like CADU, which is the Welsh equivalent of English Heritage, and they'll put these awfully positioned stone brickwork, basically things as if they're needed to hold up the capstone, or they'll put concrete reinforcing in there in order to hold the capstone up. And it just seems ridiculous to me that our ancestors built these things and they've stood there for thousands of years, and then somebody today from some government organization thinks, oh no, that's dangerous, we can improve upon that, we'll put a stonework structure underneath it to try and hold the top up, when all it needs is to be resting on the three points of the uprights. So I think
health and safety, isn't it?
Yeah, health and safety. It's just ridiculous. You know, you think these things have stood there for thousands of years, and they've managed against all the weather and what have you, and they've survived that. But will they survive the ignorance of the people that live there? As he says here in Avebury, the village itself, they started smashing them up, and as I'm pointing out here as well, even the health and safety people today end up damaging them. Well, Stukely published his findings and theories in a book, Avebury, a Temple of the British Druids, in 1743, in which it says here he intentionally falsified some of the measurements he had made of the site to better fit his theories about its design and purpose. And I guess you'd say there was just an artistic license rather than intentionally falsifying things. Meanwhile, the Reverend Thomas Twining had also published a book about the monument, Avebury in Wiltshire, the Remains of a Roman Work, which had been published in 1723. Whereas Stukely claimed that Avebury and related prehistoric monuments were the creations of the Druids, Twining thought they had been constructed by the later Romans, justifying his conclusion on the fact that Roman writers like Julius Caesar and Tacitus had not referred to stone circles when discussing the Iron Age Britons, whereas late medieval historians like Geoffrey of Monmouth and Henry of Huntingdon had described these megaliths in their works, and that such monuments must have therefore been constructed between the two sets of accounts. So we can see there where these mistakes can easily be made. Because the Romans didn't write about them, they must not have existed at that time. But that's like saying, because nobody wrote about the fossils of the dinosaurs, they never existed until the last century. You know, just because people haven't written about something that's there doesn't mean that they haven't always been there. They were just taken for granted, I guess. And you can see that there's this argument about when were these stone circles actually created. And I don't think they can be that accurate today, because you can't tell how old a stone is or when a stone was actually put in place. I mean, they can dig around and they can say, well, we've found these seeds or these remains of food from, and we can trace that back to whenever that was. But that doesn't tell us when those stones were actually erected. I think probably about 2000 BC. I mean, some of these stones, they say, that were put up like 7,000 years ago. And you just think, well, how was that possible? And we would still have difficulties doing it today with mechanics and cranes, let alone doing it with donkeys or on horseback like they were back then.
Well, constantly, the technique that's used for dating these things is improving. I mean, I can remember when the only way of dating things was carbon 14, but now there's most a lot of rock substances are contain isotopes which have got a sort of radioactive half-life, and you can calculate how long a piece of stone has been exposed to the air, and that gives you a way of dating the stone. And a lot of the skeletons that have been found over the last couple of hundred years of Paleolithic and earlier skeletons of people that lived in those far off days, you know, the dating of those has changed significantly as each method of dating from a chemical or a physical perspective has been improved. And I think that it's fairly evident that those stones do predate by a considerable period of time the appearance of the Romans.
Definitely.
I don't think that can be doubted now.
Definitely. But this was a topic of discussion that was going on in the 18th century. That, you know, there was still arguing about this, claiming that it was the Romans that had actually built them. Well, Stukeley placed an emphasis on measuring and recording historical sites and encouraged his various correspondents to do the same. He engaged in excavation by digging in and around archaeological sites, relating that doing so was like an anatomical dissection. He recognized the principle of stratigraphy, that different layers of soil reflected different periods in the development of a site. So he was quite important for archaeology, really. I mean, taking these plans and drawing them exactly as they were, these stone circles, knowing that they were being smashed up at quite a rate of knots, and also working out that when he was digging through them, it had to be looked at like an anatomical dissection of a body, because he was also an anatomical doctor, and he had also dissected bodies from the gallows. So he was looking at doing the same thing with these archaeological sites. I mean, Britain is really big in the archaeological scene. If you look back at the early archaeologists, particularly when we had the British Empire, we would go out and we would look at these sites of historical importance that had just been ignored for thousands of years by the people that were living there, and we would dig them up and look through the layers of soil and find out everything we could about history. Like L.A. Waddell discovered the birthplace of the Buddha. We had Flinders Petrie, our great Egyptologist. We had people out in Assyria, in Nineveh, in Syria, all British archaeologists that were discovering this hidden history. And it all took place within the British Empire. I mean, I'd like to do Flinders Petrie as one of our greatest Britons eventually. Pigott described Stukeley as a gregarious creature who enjoyed conversation and being flattered. And Pigott is his most recent autobiographist. There have been some biographies that have been written of Stukeley recently, and Pigott's is the main one. Haycock referred to Stukeley's amiable personality, while Pigott also highlighted an immensely likeable quality to Stukeley's personality, as evidence highlighting that when the Reverend was laid up in bed in Queen's Square on one occasion, over 120 friends and parishioners either visited him or sent him a message of sympathy. He also regarded the antiquary as displaying a charm and pleasant oddness, as well as a cheerfulness and disarming ingenuousness. Pigott also noted that in later life, Stukeley became self-opinionated and dogmatic. So he got some negative traits there as well. But he does sound like a traditional British eccentric, a very nice fellow, a very interesting chap to talk to, who had this massive influence on London at the time, basically, and this understanding of Druidry and of these stone circles. He retained his concern with the destruction of ancient monuments, in particular the pillaging of Hadrian's Wall for stone, imploring Princess Augusta to intervene and raising the issue in a November 1757 report for the Society of Antiquaries. He also raised concerns about the sturdiness of the Eleanor Cross at Waltham Cross and ensured that it was renovated. So he's not just taking an interest in megaliths, just any ancient artifacts that we have. He wanted to preserve and prevent them from breaking down anymore for future generations. In 1757, Stukeley's second wife died, and in 1759, Stukeley purchased a cottage in the then largely rural area of Kentish Town to the north of London. In 1763, he published Paleographia Sacra, or Discourses on Sacred Subjects, as a collection of some of his Sunday sermons. In early 1765, Stukeley suffered a stroke, fell into a coma, and remained in this state for 3 days before dying in his bed on the 3rd of March. He was 77 years old. He was buried without a monument in the churchyard of St. Mary Magdalene's Church, East Ham, which he is said to have selected as his resting place on a visit there during his lifetime. So, I mean, he must have been quite a fascinating fellow to go along to and experience one of his sermons in the churches. You think he's an archaeologist, he's an anatomist, he's a philosopher, he's got this interest in religion, and he's giving these sermons in the church, which sort of tied all these interests together for the parishioners. And you can see how well liked he was by the number of people that came to see him when he was ill. You got any comments on any of that, Max?
I think what you say is perfectly correct, that he was blending different strands of study together in an interesting way, where truths could be deduced from the similarities and the common aspects of those lines of study, and in that respect, he was an exceptional man.
Well, it was a very patriotic way that he was looking at things as well. I mean, he was instilling a sense of national pride in Britain, in its archaeology and in its heritage. I mean, you have English Heritage Today, which is the organisation that preserves lots of these stone circles. And if it wasn't for Stukeley, we would never have anything like that. I mean, he was saying this is Britain's heritage. This is far more important than going out onto the continent and going to have a look at the ruins in Greece. You know, why not look at the ruins on your own doorstep? Go to Stonehenge, go to Avebury, and marvel at how these things were created and what they were created for, because it shows that there was a high standard of civilization. And as we've learned since then, there was a high standard of astronomy as well, because of the way that these structures were aligned with the stars and with the sunrise and the sunset. Well, Haycock noted that Stukeley's books Stonehenge and Avebury were well received, and that scholars should not lose sight of his achievements behind the screen of his failings. He noted that Stukeley was not a lone figure hypothesizing wildly in his study, but participating in a philosophical debate that attracted the attention of various Enlightenment figures, including Isaac Newton, adding that Stukeley had established himself in a firm position in London's intellectual society. By the early 1720s, Stukeley had a growing reputation as the country's main authority on Druids and ancient monuments, having no obvious competitor, given the comparative novelty of studying stone circles. However, by the 1750s, some of Stukeley's contemporaries were criticising the accuracy of some of his plans, and some were also accusing his interpretations of being speculative. So he's sort of socialising with Isaac Newton and with the scientists of his day. So they all had an influence one on the other. And I guess the scientific way that Newton was looking at things would have played into the way that Stukeley was looking at these druids of the past and saying, well, what were they doing when they were building these stone circles? What was it they were trying to represent here? And you can imagine that there would have been a lot of discussion about this that we probably don't have today. In the same way that people will discuss philosophy and what have you in the forums, on the internet. I mean, back then you had these meetings once a week in London of the Archaeological Society and the Royal Society. You'd had these scientists there and these archaeologists and Stukeley there, and they would have been talking about these things and trying to work out what it was that our ancients believed and why it was that they were doing these things. And they were also, you know, incredibly patriotic. Nothing like people today that were so self-effacing. you know, they weren't shy of saying that, that Britain was a leading nation in Europe, and the Britons had conquered the world and had the British Empire. These were all things that we were proud of back then, and things that Stukeley wanted to encourage in his readers, a sense of pride in what we have in Britain. Haycock observed...
One of the things I think is sort of interesting is that it took so long before somebody like Stukeley came along and said, you know, perhaps we ought to study these stone circles and read more into them than just regarding them as worthless relics of the past. You know, I think that the destruction of the stones at Avebury was particularly sort of... reflects particularly badly on the people of Avebury at the time, because even today, if you happen upon the stone circle at Avebury, as I did, I'm not quite sure whether I've mentioned that to our listeners in the past, but you know, I just happened to discover Avebury by completely by accident. But it was the size of the stones and the size of the stone circle was such that when I got home finishing my journey, I wasn't able to stay there at the time because it was the middle of the night. It was lashing down with rain. I had to get home. I was soaked through. But by the time I got home the following day, I then sort of retraced my steps to find where this place was, where these standing stones were, and then went back and visited the place, and I've visited it several times since. So, you know, the stone circle, both at Stonehenge and Avebury, are remarkable things that you can't see and not realise the importance of. And it's just, I find it amazing that it took to the 1700s before somebody like Stukeley came along and decided that these things ought to be protected.
Well, I guess it's like you don't realise the importance and the grandeur of your surroundings. If you were just brought up there all your life around these stones, you really wouldn't think anything of them unless you'd come across them by surprise, like you did, Max. I mean, the people that were brought up there, they just saw this as, well, this is building materials for us, isn't it? We can just smash up what's here and use it to rebuild houses. And it's in a similar way, like the Romans. Roman houses were sort of smashed up and were reused. When the tide was coming in and along the beach, and there were a lot of Roman settlements that ended up being underwater. And before that would happen, the stones would all be taken apart and they'd be used for rebuilding. So I imagine it was a similar thing that was going on here. I think the same thing went on in Egypt as well. You know, they were the Arabs were taking apart the pyramids and using the stone for building material. And I think they may even have been using the papyrus, reusing these ancient papyruses that had ancient stuff that was written on them. And it was just taken for granted that this papyrus would always be there, and we could reuse it for newspapers or toilet paper or whatever. You know, we don't appreciate the value in what we have all around us sometimes. Well, Haycock observed that Stukeley's influence upon antiquarian studies for the century or so after his death was profound. For instance, in his 1796 book, Indian Antiquities, Thomas Maurice drew upon Stukeley's publications as part of his argument that the Druids were a group of Indian Brahmins who had travelled west. According to Haycock, the most famous propagator of Stukeleyan ideas in the early 19th century was the artist and poet William Blake, who had read both Avebury and Stonehenge and been influenced by them. In the 19th century, many of Stukeley's interpretations were being adopted and expanded by several antiquarian clergymen, including William Lyell Bowles, D. James, and John Bathurst Dean. The Wiltshire archaeologist Richard Colt Hoare gave Stukeley's work some additional respectability when praising his use of fieldwork. Hoare concurred with Stukeley that sites such as Stonehenge and Avebury were likely Celtic, but he did not endorse the idea that they were built by Druids, believing that such information was unknowable. Of course, William Blake was an incredibly famous artist and poet. Didn't he write Jerusalem as well? I'm a big fan of William Blake's work. So he was influenced a lot by Stukeley as well. According to his biographer, Stuart Piggott, Stukeley was the central figure of early 18th century archaeology. The historian Ronald Hutton called him perhaps the most important forefather of the discipline of archaeology, while the archaeologist Paul Ashby referred to Stukeley as a pioneer unmatched in the history of archaeology. The first edition of Piggott's biography of Stukeley was published in 1950, with a revised edition released in 1985. Piggott thought him one of the most curious and complex of the English eccentrics, pathetic, charming, admirable, and laughable by turns. Piggott believed that Stukeley's folios of Avebury and Stonehenge were his most important contributions to archaeology, and he noted that the antiquarian's plan of Avebury, although failing by modern standards of accuracy, was nevertheless a very much better achievement than anything that had been produced before. Piggott's ultimate assessment was that Stukeley was not a good scholar, he was uncritical of his literary sources, and his reading was discursive rather than profound. His value to archaeology in his own day and now lies in his capacity to observe and record the facts in the open air. He situated Stukeley's intellectual failings within the wider context of British intellectual decline in the years following 1730, and Stukeley was the first person to identify the Stonehenge Avenue and the Stonehenge Cursus, giving these features the names by which they are now known. So that's interesting. So it's acknowledged that there was an intellectual decline in the years following 1730. I wonder if that was to do with the Darwinian pressures being relieved somewhat with medicine and with better sewage and with more air in the homes. Florence Nightingale, she was responsible for a lot of that, wasn't she? I was wondering if this intellectual decline coincided with that, with more people being born and making it through to adulthood rather than dying at a younger age and then going on to reproduce other people that weren't the finest examples of our type that we had at this point. Because we certainly had lots of polymaths and incredibly intelligent people around at this time. We had the Enlightenment, we had the Royal Society, we had all this new understanding of the world around us, steam and railways and the Industrial Revolution all sort of came about at the same time. And Stukeley's important role in this was to archaeology and getting us to appreciate the value of what we had around us. I think he was a wonderful eccentric. I think I'm going to try and get a copy of his biography, I think, the revised edition released in 1985. Let's hope it's not too politically correct. Max, you got any final thoughts on William Stukeley here?
I think it's really what I said a bit earlier on, that I think Stukeley, one of the remarkable things that Stukeley did was to recognise the value of preserving monuments like Stonehenge and the Avebury Stone Circle. And he was somebody in his day who saw that circle and recognised it immediately, in the same way that, you know, when I drove through Avebury that time, that I instantly recognised that there was something special about these standing stones. And also, a bit further south than Avebury was Silbury Hill. I think as you drive past Silbury Hill on the way to Devizes, for example, if you're heading that way from Swindon, the road passes very closely by the foot of Silbury Hill, and you can't drive past Silbury Hill, or in those days ride past it in a horse and carriage, without realising that there's something very remarkable about Silbury Hill. It's just not something that you would expect to see. It's not a natural phenomenon. It's obviously something that's man-made. This sort of conical mound, basically, what would appear to be perhaps a small hill, but conically shaped, with a slight flattening on the very top of it. As I say, it surprises me that it took so long for somebody like Stukeley to sort of come along and see it. And it's remarkable that Stukeley had these interests in the various threads of philosophy and religion that he was that he was motivated to try and find commonalities and things that blended those things together rather than regarding them as something that were entirely separate.
Yeah, I think looking at the size of them, I mean, it really points to the remarkable abilities of the people that built them in the first place. So it gives this sense of pride in being British, and that we built these structures and they're still standing there today, thousands of years later. And it's a testament to our ancestors and to the sorts of things that we should still be coming up with today. We have to look to the past to know where we have come from and where we are going. He was certainly very patriotic minded, very nationalist minded, and he certainly did a great service to the British people in recording what he did about Avebury and Stonehenge. Well, I think we'll leave that here for today then, Max. Thank you very much for coming on today.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more Real Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.